Here on Groove 107.7 FM, on the phone with me, Joanne Drayton, who has just put out a book, which is called The Search for Anne Perry. Now, Anne Perry, of course, is better known as Juliet Hume, and you may remember recently we were looking at other books in regard to the Hume-Parker murder from the 1950s, 1954, in Victoria Park. Now, this story has changed a lot over time, hasn't it, Joanne?
Absolutely, yes. It's one that, well, some aspects of it don't change, and perhaps the attitudes we've taken to the story have been very much set in a certain perspective, a certain way of looking at it. So we tend as New Zealanders to have a knee-jerk reaction to all that we've heard and been told and, you know, that we've read in our newspapers and things like that. So to some extent there's an underlying consistency in terms of the buy-up for this or take-up or whatever. But I think in terms of evolution, I think that, you know, definitely I think new generations, new people should bring a new perspective to this, and I think they're probably the outstanding positive from the book that I've just been able to write is the access I've had to Anne Perry. So that's brought a voice for her, and I hope, you know, a new perspective to something that we tend to have set in a groove over. And I think lots of stories that become part of our identity almost, they become part of the fabric of who we are. Our reactions to them define who we are. There's a sense of nationhood almost in that reaction. They do need to be reviewed, and they do need to be released from, you know, the 1950s, and this is particularly one of those stories.
That's certainly true, and you mentioned that in some of the later chapters, because your book starts off by looking at Anne's current life and the intrusion of finally discovering who she really was after she's become quite a famous writer.
Sure.
In the early days, and even her publisher didn't know, and her publishing agent didn't know, and so this is a bit of a shock to her initially. But before I start that, I would like to start with yourself. Like, why did you come to want to do this biography?
Well, I am from Christchurch, and in a way, Christchurch owns the story like no one else, or no other place in New Zealand. I guess we all do, but Christchurch, it happened there. It was the first place that shocked surprise and horror really began, you know. And so that's where I come from, and my mother went to girls' high, her friends went to girls' high. I actually taught briefly. I was a relieving teacher at girls' high. I was there when Peter Jackson introduced Heavenly Creatures by chance. I just happened to be lucky enough to get a ticket, and I was sitting in the front row. Right, almost, I could have just about reached out and touched him. And in some ways, it's been part of my childhood. When I was at university, when I was relief teaching at girls' high, doing a PhD. And so it very much felt like it's part of my history. And it was one of those, I felt there was more to write, and it's one of those sensational, fantastic West End shows in a way that I felt had run on and run on and run on endlessly, a bit like the Mousetrap. And I felt that there was some more acts to add to that play, to kind of finish it off, to sort of resolve it to some extent, and certainly that's what I hoped to achieve by writing the biography. But of course, initially I didn't have permission from Anne Perry, and it was something that I had to really work very hard and be very persistent to get. And in a way, it was an accidental persistence, really, too. So that's quite
Yes, well, tell me, how did you get to that point? And just before we do that, you mentioned, obviously, Peter Jackson's film, and we must acknowledge that without, I guess, without the murders in the first place, obviously Peter Jackson and Richard Taylor wouldn't have made such a fantastic film.
Sure.
Obviously, you know, Kate Winslet wouldn't have gone on to be the actress she was, and an uncanny resemblance, which is just crazy. And all these things wouldn't have happened, and we wouldn't have understood perhaps a little bit more about them either. It would have been the stigmatized, you know, thing from Time Life or The Listener or something in this black and white dire thing. So we've learnt a little bit more about them along the way.
We certainly have. That's true. That's absolutely right. I agree. I actually agree. That's the movie did. It was a movie that changed in our consciousness. That, in a way, locked people into a sense of awareness and sort of empathy in a strange sort of way for those young women. And I think it was really helpful in moving. Well, it moved New Zealand on a bit, and I think that it is a process, and it was part of that process to move things on. And I think I was amazed by the film when I saw it, and I remember actually coming out I had food poisoning because I was sitting in the front row desperately taking the last two seats. And then running, those girls running through, I figured out later on I had motion sickness. So I was so consumed by that movie and so, you know, swept up in it, which, you know, I think a lot of people were, that I think it did begin to reframe something that was horrific, but which we have to understand. Well, if we can understand from the perspective of the girls, I think that's really helpful.
Well, true. Do you know if Anne Perry's ever seen this film?
Yeah, I do. I do know she hasn't seen it.
Right.
She's a person who's been quite brutalised in many ways by the media, and I think that seeing it would be very confronting for her, and I think it's associated with her outing the revelation of her as, you know, as Juliet Hume, and I think it has a lot of connotations that are quite negative for her. She does feel that I think that the characters, her parents particularly, you know, she has some feelings that they weren't as rounded and as comprehensively, compassionately recreated in a way. But I think, you know, it's a movie. It really was a movie about a relationship as much as anything else, and it was the girls' relationship that it focused on.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And if the parents weren't more angular, then they wouldn't have made particularly good procrastinators, so you wouldn't have said, you know, you may have said, well, you know, these girls really were a bit crazy because, after all, they had lovely families.
And yeah.
It wasn't the case, but...
I think you're right. I think, I mean, this is a medium of, you know, dramatic visual way of communicating, and I think there's certain constraints about making a good film that are different to... But I think what it did was it communicated a very powerful message.
Indeed. You know, yes. One of the things I found interesting, not to dwell on the film too much, but in context, just bring it back to your book, was that at the very end of the film, there is the usual blurb, now what are they doing? And in that particular case, it mentioned that the new life of Anne Perry is actually writing murder mysteries. And the interesting thing I found about that is that New Zealanders have owned this concept that how is it that you can be in a position to write murder mysteries having committed one yourself? How dare she? You know, this, particularly, and how dare Kate Winslet do it? Because after all, we have no other flesh embodiment now.
I see what you mean.
How dare she do that?
In other words, they can't own another life, in a way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How she rubbed this in.
Yeah.
Having said that, of course, we now know that the people that write these various things are not always completely twisted or whatever. And but it is kind of unusual. Normally we expect murder mystery people and things like this to be these nice young people or these, you know, Agatha Christie or something like that, and we discover that they're... That they're only twisted in their head and they keep that to themselves and they've never actually acted out, like, for instance, an axe murderer or something. Serial murderer.
I think in Anne's case, it is interesting. I mean, I find that fascinating, I have to say. So I do find it fascinating who writes murder mysteries and why, because, you know, I'm interested in Agatha Christie, I'm interested in Naya Marsh. Why did those women do that? I find that fascinating. I think, and Anne Perry has her own reasons as well, and they're good reasons. I think Naya Marsh and Agatha Christie did it because in their time, that was a way for women to gain some sort of power and some audience and some independence. And in fact, a phenomenal independence, really, if you look at their earnings. With Anne Perry, she wrote over and over again these stories that were sort of nebulous, endless, kind of very, very powerful characters, interesting scenes. I know because I know some of the people that have read them. But they lacked the sort of structure, the sinew of the crime detective novel, which gives a sort of body to that writing. It has a beginning and an end. It has a sort of intention often as well. So, I think she would have walked over hot coals to have actually had one of the other historical novels accepted in that early stage, and I think she would have preferred that. That's really what she wants to write in many respects. However, her forte was, the crime detective fiction formula, and of course you can't argue with the fact that she brings something to it, a knowledge and an empathy and a compassion for some of those characters, which no one that I know of can bring, because it's so personal and it's so immediate for her.
It definitely is. Let's start with her life. We'll just go through a few things here. She was released from prison eventually, which I find rather interesting that she was in prison for an indefinite period originally, wasn't she?
That's right, yeah. Absolutely.
Which is the strangest thing.
Difficult, very difficult, very, very difficult. She says this, you can't cross the days off to anything. You don't ever know. So she was there on an endless... sentence that she never ever could work towards the end or see the end of, and I think, wow, that was a tough call for both of those girls.
It certainly was, and you know, hanging around in the background was the hangman's noose back then, of course.
Sure, absolutely.
Which, although that was ruled out, could still come back at any point.
Well, it was. They were under 18, so it wasn't an issue for them. But of course, it was continuing to carry, you know, the hangings were occurring around Anne Perry or Juliet Hume in the prison, and she was aware of them, and if she didn't hear the exact noises of the, although they were quite resounding, the trap door on the scaffolding, so it used to bang against the side of the iron, and it was practices, you know, with the sandbag before the actual act. So certainly she was aware of all of the talk, the intensity. It's a small community, very obviously incredibly tightly knit, and in a very strange sort of way, incredibly intense. And in that environment, there's a lot of talk, there's a lot of awareness, and so she was privy to all of that. And that's a heavy thing for a 15-year-old, 16-year-old.
Yeah. And at the same time, she continues to correspond with Pauline?
No, she doesn't have any contact at all with Pauline. Yeah, absolutely doesn't.
So no. Do you know if she ever found her again?
No. Yeah. Oh, well, I do know. I think it's an interesting thing, isn't it? And it's quite helpful to put yourself in the situation that those two girls and as adults women are now. It was one of the most horrific, awful, shocking events of both of their lives. I'm absolutely certain of that. And to go back and to go back to those people and to go back to Pauline or to go back to Juliet is like going back there for them, going back to the scene of that terrible event.
Okay, so when she finally leaves, and she leaves prison, and she goes, she works on a number of jobs and finally becomes a nanny in the States, and then through a certain amount of isolation, she becomes a Mormon.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, the Mormon Church really has been one of the, I think, the sort of foundations of what she's built her really effective adult life on. She was isolated. She was in San Francisco, not just on the edge of San Francisco, and as a nanny. And people next door were Mormons. She was quite isolated. I think she was looking for something. She was looking for something anyway, and she had had quite a connection to religion before. But I think it was the Mormon Church, especially, that offered her the structure, the way of life, the values, and also their take on a sort of life after death and salvation and things like that.
Mm.
So yeah, so it became her. Yeah, a real touchstone for her, and she's maintained her connection to the Mormon Church right through, even though it's problematic for her at times.
Yes, I was about to say, one of the lines that you've got in here, which I found rather interesting, is you said her first Victorian novel, which is the Cater Street one.
Yes.
She said that she's actually cuttingly critical of organised religion.
Yes.
Particularly when she, when one of her main characters is the Reverend Preble, and he turns up and he's totally pompous.
Oh, he's horrible.
And he's a representative of your exact fire and brimstone type minister, which, in the back of our minds, is exactly what we expect to be in the Mormon Church as well, don't we?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that you do have that association with the Mormon Church, and I don't think it's entirely fair. I think what she's probably actually hitting at more there is the mainstream churches, where I think not so much the Mormon Church, which I think she sees as having a more sincere and sort of straightforward connection to religion, whereas the mainstream churches, a lot of ministers have used that for its a social position, for the power that it gives them, for the glory of themselves, not just their religion. And so I think that she's looking at hypocrisy in a way that she loves to look at hypocrisy, and she looks at it in various forms, but one of the places that, particularly in the 19th century, because remember, she's taking it back to the 19th century, when the many clergy were involved in the church, not because of their calling, but because it was actually a job for an upper or a middle-class male. You know, there was the army and the church and the law or something like that. So, you know, so she is putting it in its time, and she's looking at the hypocrisy, which is something that she feels very, she hits at really strongly, and I really appreciate that in her novel. She takes on the establishment and the status quo and gives it a good, good run for its money.
Well, she certainly does, and that was interesting in itself, because I found it interesting, your little comment at the beginning about when Anne is discovered, inverted commas, with Peter Jackson's film coming out, with the various the media coming forward, and yet she is a part of the media, so she's been outed even though she's part of it. I know she's the fictitious part, but as part of the machinery that's required to sell a novel, to sell a book, whatever, you create a certain persona around yourself,
and
then that's cracked itself. And to one degree, it was interesting that you were just saying when I first talked to you that the Australians were as interested as the New Zealanders are.
Yes.
In one sense.
Yes.
And yet, being an author, you never expect to know. I mean, New Zealand has a great tradition of authors who, for want of a better term, are a little bit loopy, like Janet Frang, for example, who, I know it's not a fair comment, but they have their own world. They are themselves, and yet they need to use the media to promote themselves, obviously, otherwise no one will read their books.
Yeah, that's an interesting dilemma. I think, you know, it's the Princess Diana one, isn't it?
Yes.
In that, there's a relationship that you have if you want a profile, and the media creates a profile. And you don't always have the power to manipulate that, or don't actually think you do have the power to manipulate that. That's why people listen to the media, because they feel that it has a kind of a kind of independence. And I think that inevitably, if you're a writer, you have to engage in that world. You can't help it. And the interesting thing is that, as you say, often these people are introverts of one sort or another. They do live in their created world. They do tend to live in an imaginative world. That's what they draw on for their characters, their scenes, So in a way, it is a little bit of a mismatch, you know. And I mean, it's an interesting point to make, because there you have someone, quite often writers are introverted, do draw on this odd world that they create in their head. And so, you know, when they're confronted with the media, it is an awkward fit sometimes. And, you know, sometimes it isn't, but often it is. And it is something that I guess they have to deal with. Anne Perry was known by the media, and had engaged with the media as Anne Perry. The problem for her was when, you know, the two identities or the two parts of her life were joined up, it threw things open for her, and it sort of potentially sent her life into a kind of free fall for a while. You know, she didn't know when that was going to end, and where it would end, and what people she would lose on that fall. But it's a difficult situation, but it's one that if you want to be successful in a way, many authors do have to navigate.
Well, that's true. And just going backwards a bit there was a couple of points I wanted to pick up on. First of all, this creation of Anne Perry. We had Anne Perry, the private person, then we have Anne Perry, the writer. And that came about after she came back to the UK and settled in a small farm in the middle of nowhere.
Yes.
And then she ran into Meg.
Yes.
Which I'd like you to expand on that, because Meg's been in her life virtually ever since.
Yes.
And yet she didn't really know her.
No, that was that she met Meg in the context of the Mormon Church.
Yes.
And Meg McDonald, and she...
Who's the literary agent, we might point out.
Okay, there's two Megs in her story.
Ah.
Meg 1 and Meg 2, which I couldn't do when I was writing the book, so... There's Meg Davis. Yeah, Meg Davis is her agent. And, Meg went to work for MBA, which is the literary agency that Anne had associated herself with, and Meg was young. She's a Canadian, and young, I don't know, sort of 28, something like that, when she met Anne Perry, and she was full of this sort of gusto of pushing this career on, and so she really took it up like a... I guess she was ambitious to be a great agent. She was wanted to make a way for herself as well, you know, establish her reputation in London in a very competitive field. And so she gave this career, which was sort of ambling along and quite successful, this massive push of enthusiasm and strategy and confidence that she brought to it, the confidence to some extent of youth, and drove Anne Perry on to another level, which she was quite capable of achieving, but and then of course there was Don Mass later on, who joined and added his input as well. So she has been well supported by some really sharp, intelligent, and I've met them, people that I admire and, you know, I think respect for their individual achievements, you know, that.
Which is one thing we should point out about your book is it's, as much as it's about Anne, it's also quite a lot about the publishing world and how it's not really a prescription for writing a book, but it's an interesting to show how, well, I found it quite fascinating to show how all these fragmented things went from, well, if you wind back, you get this these original stories which may have contributed to the original murder, then went away, got buried, and then come back later on in a more mature format, I guess, and then you go through the whole literary process of actually publishing them.
What I think is...
So they're going to get out somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing is that Anne Perry loves writing. She just loves it, and she feels, I think she can't, you know, she really, it's so much a part of her life, she can't really stop in a way, or doesn't want to stop. And I think that this is the most channeled and most helpful, I think, in terms of the structure that was set up at MBA, the agents that she had. And so she carried on writing. She wrote most of the way through. I think she even wrote when she was sort of drifting between jobs and trying things out. I think she wrote little, nothing extended because it was pretty full-on lifestyle. But she carried on writing, and it is something that is... she's driven to do, and it's something that she it is Anne Perry, her writing, in a way, you know.
Well, you're a writer too, and you've actually put out quite a body of work. So, what's the driver for you for these things?
My driver, in a way, is I look for a problem. And I look for a case in which someone has not received what they should have received. So, in other words, I take lives that could almost disappear from our consciousness and bring them back and give that career some context in New Zealand back again. I rediscover them in a way for New Zealand. And I think that has to happen on a regular basis, even with someone like Frances Hodgkins, you know, who we're reasonably well familiar with. But in a way, those books bring them back in a new sense, with a new sense of life and vitality, and they bring, you know, you bring inevitably a new perspective to it. And so with Anne Perry, I was fascinated by, obviously I did Nia Marsh, so wrote a biography of Nia Marsh, so the crime detective fiction was fascinating for me. And then beyond that was the situation that this is a young, well, we think of her as a young woman. She's actually, you know, 73, going
on
74.
She's had, you know, three lives since then.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I wanted to bring the adult to New Zealand's consciousness in a new way. I wanted to, in a way, confront people with the person that she's become so that we can let that person grow up and become the kind of complex, interesting, and generous, warm, and very intelligent person that she is, and not leave her in that mad, bad, evil sort of old story that needs to be added to be contextualised and to be understood. So, you know, basically, there was a story for me that I felt I felt I had to tell. I really wanted to tell it. I was really disappointed when they turned me down and they said no, you know. Well, I didn't know actually, but they said to me no, but they also said no, no way, because she's from the wrong address basically, and it'll get Anne's heckles up. So, you know, I had to struggle over the fact that I was a New Zealander, and so it was hard to beat that one.
You had to push your way through.
Yeah.
And when you finally met her, she'd Did she let her guard down, or does she? Was that a slow trust process?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Mm. I think not so. You are right. She is a person who takes a long time to trust someone, because I think trust is tricky for her. Mm. But I think she did. It was a slow thing. It was a bit of a. I've used that word before, but it was a bit of a waiting game, because I needed her to feel comfortable with me and feel easy enough and relaxed enough to be herself, to kind of come out really from behind the formalities. And that happened. But it was slow. You can't race people into that, and especially someone who's had trust as an issue for many years. Yeah, yeah, it has been a real issue for you. Who does she trust? Sometimes I think, even herself, she it's taken her years, I think, for her to feel confident, even in her own judgments and her own instincts about things. And, I think that's happened now, but it's been a long time.
And some things like these sort of things that have happened many, many years ago, and I'm thinking more political situations, but I think the New Zealand public, to some degree, almost want an apology or an acknowledgement that, I've done this thing.
Yes.
And by doing that, you can actually shut the door properly.
Sure.
Do you think that's now happened?
I think it has.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really do. Yeah, I really, really do.
Yeah, so this is like the cases of somebody who's involved in, say, a car crash, a drunken...
Sure.
Somebody gets drunk and kills somebody or something like that. It's almost, because it's youth, it's almost, not frivolous is the right word, but something that is, something that happened in your past and you don't want it to define your life, but you need to get through that. And because of the situation where she was locked up and kind of disappeared, and then even her family disappeared as well for a while, it's kind of like that didn't happen, and maybe that's part of why... New Zealanders have held on to this because of that mystery that kicked in.
Yeah, I think it is all in the mix for sure, for certain. And I think she has apologised and profusely, and I think and that has happened. But it's lovely that in a way she could talk to me Diana Wichita, and also Guy and Espina.
Yes,
and
on television, so we actually saw who this person was for real.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, you can actually watch the full interview with Guy on and Anne on their site,
yeah.
Which I really do recommend, because it's what you saw was really, I think, well chosen. But certainly excerpts from a very comprehensive, quite a comprehensive interview, and I was there, and I felt it was quite a moving experience actually, and it was quite special. She developed a really nice rapport with Guy and Espina, and she felt relaxed. I saw her relax, and she just was warm and. She has a strong feeling for New Zealand. That's what surprised me when I met her. And it was quite odd when Guy and Espina and the cameraman and I and Anne were together. It was almost like we were the New Zealanders and the other people in the party were English. And you can see very profoundly that a formative part of who Anne is was determined and defined by New Zealand, her New Zealand experiences. She knows New Zealanders. She feels quite comfortable with them, beyond the pursuit and the sort of stalking that's occurred for her over the years by some of the media here.
Mm.
So she, when she can actually be with New Zealanders who aren't totally judging her, who aren't doing that trip on her all the time, she actually. I think she goes back there to something she knows, something that's familiar, and there's a lot of warmth and a lot of sincerity in that, in those interchanges, and it's quite amazing to see, for me. And I was lucky to get that opportunity, because I saw her one-on-one with me. I didn't see her in the context of a sort of small Kiwi team, if you like.
Mm.
And it was she felt like in some way she moved over. She with us, she became something of a Kiwi. She understood the jokes. She understood the personality, the way we operate, and it was quite obviously there in her memory bank.
Wow, that's cool. Well, thank you so much for talking to us. Now, but just before I go, what's next for you?
Well, heavens, I'm still working on this, you know, but I'm interested in so many things. I'm actually quite interested in the Queens of Crime. And I'm interested in looking at Naya Marsh again, maybe with a picture book or something like that. I don't know. I've got lots. I've got a list as long as your arm of ideas. And I always start like that, and then somehow you get led through this list, and sometimes you come back to it. And you revisit those names again. So I've also got some interesting international careers I'd love to look at. I'd love to look at Annie Leibovitz and Susan Sontag. So some local that are there that I feel I'd like to write, and some that are beyond New Zealand, which is, you know, something I'd quite like to do as well, tackle something that doesn't necessarily have that Kiwi automatic Kiwi connection.
Wow, we'll look forward to that. Thanks, Joanne. I've been talking to Joanne Drayton, who has just written a wonderful book called The Search for Anne Perry, which, of course, is Juliet Hume as the writer incarnate. Thank you so much for your time. This has been fascinating.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed talking to you.